These days, most people find it easier to lock eyes with a screen than with another person. Yet we are innately social beings. So what happened? And what can we do about it? You're listening to Wellness 3.0, and I'm your host, Amy Bagland. In this episode, I have the pleasure of digging deep with Dr. Rachel Abrams, voted the best doctor in Santa Cruz County for 9 years running. Rachel has quite the resume. After graduating Phi Beta Kappa from Stanford University, she received her MD from UC San Francisco and a master's degree in holistic health from UC Berkeley. She's board certified in family medicine and integrative medicine, or as she calls herself in this episode, a weird hippie doctor. At her award-winning integrative medicine clinic in Santa Cruz, Dr. Abrams treats many of the world's most influential people. Rachel's happily married to her fellow author and husband, Doug, and the mother of three fabulous young adults. Listen on as we talk about why Rachel thinks we're in a cultural crisis and how relationships and connection are the answer. A bit of neuroscience that explains how all living beings are connected to each other and to nature. We'll talk about her new book, 8 Dates, about powerful conversations that you can have to get real, about difficult topics like money, sex, family, dreams, etc. And finally, we'll learn what in the world Naked Shabbat is. We're just gonna be able to see each other, which is great. That's so much more fun. Okay, so this is so interesting that you're going on this trip with Michelle, my friend Michelle, to Africa.
Right.
Yeah. So who's the woman who's organizing this?
Saida Desolée. So Saida's been a good friend of mine for a long time, like since 2002.
Okay.
And she and I met in the Taoist sexuality world. I've written 3 books on Taoism and sexuality, or 2, I guess. My husband wrote the other one. And I met her when I was working on one of those books at a Taoist retreat center in Thailand. And we just hit it off and had a really good time together. And we've been friends ever since. And now she does all kinds of stuff, still primarily around sexuality. And I have a broader base. I mean, I'm an actual family practice doctor, practicing doctor, right. But I also write about relationship and I write about environment and I write about personal health and women's health and, you know, listening to your body. But all those themes are important for her too. So that's why we're friends and we're,
so cool.
Professionally and personally.
Well, it sounds like you guys have an amazing trip lined up. So
yes!
I am going to be
excited. It's on my
enviously,
bucket
list. Yeah. Oh, cool. I'm going to be endlessly watching. So when I saw you on stage at Wisdom, I was so excited because you and Doug have this just really like kind of new guard energy that's just like young and fresh. And in the world of relationships, I think that's something that we don't see a lot. And there's amazing people who have been doing work for decades. And they really started this work, the Gottmans and John Gray. And, you know, I mean, without them, this wouldn't. I don't think we'd be where we're at. But to see, I kind of felt like watching you on stage with the Gottmans that there was like this handing off of the torch or something happening. Maybe I made up the whole thing, but that's what it seems like.
Well, I think that, I mean, Doug and I are not in the same, we're friends with Harville and Helen Hendricks and a lot of people in this space. We're not the same because couples work is not our primary focus.
Okay.
But it's hugely, hugely important to both of us, has been our whole, well, I mean, that's why we're together, because it's got to learn. It takes a lot of effort, you know, it takes a lot of personal work and knowledge and research and therapy and, you know, to have a really exciting marriage. And we do have a really exciting marriage.
Yeah.
A little too
Naked
exciting.
Shabbat. Naked Shabbat sounds pretty exciting.
So what I'm literally doing right now, so I've done work on sexuality. I've done work on romantic relationships. I just wrote Body Wise, which is really about your relationship with yourself, but talks a lot about social relationship as one of the 5 fundamentals of wellness.
Mm-hmm.
And the health statistics on it are impressive. They're better. It's more important to not be lonely. It's more important to have love in your life than it is whether you smoke cigarettes or how you eat or whether you exercise. Much more important, actually, in terms of your health, in terms of whether you get sick, when you get sick, and how long you live. So I have been speaking about that stuff for a long time, but the newest context in which I'm doing it is right relationship. So right relationship, talking about right relationship with self, what does that look like, which is really my Body Wise book, which if you don't have, might be interesting for you. I have a whole chapter on community and health in it.
So I will have to pick it up. Right now I have 8 dates sitting on my coffee table. It just arrived. So I'm going to start with that, but we'll definitely order Body Wise too. And I was looking at the webpage for it and already found myself pretty captivated by it.
Well, it's just up your alley. It's what you're talking about. So right relationship is right relationship with self, right relationship with others. So that's both romantic relationship, friendship, family, and community. And then right relationship with nature. So that's the third arm that I'm really working at. And the three are intimately related to one another and important. And when you look at what's going on in terms of health and wellness, both physical and psychological in our United States, we're suffering from the lack of those three things in a major way. And it's still coming down the pike. The millennials are the most anxious generation we've ever had in history since we started notating. So,
and on top of that, they're working from home. Over 50% of them are working from home and not in standard workplaces, which is just a double whammy, I think, of isolation.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So we have a lot of work to do, but I think this is exactly the place to do it. And I'm super turned on about it because I think that if people really understand that you are actually connected to other people, you can't help it. It's part of how our bodies work and, you know, the width of our cardiac electrical field and our mirror neurons. And, you know, we're wired to be connected to others and we can't really help but be influenced by and connected to others. And we're connected like that to nature also. And I'm really hoping that by drawing those parallels with people, that they will get more interested and excited about both being in nature and taking better care of it, because it really is just like taking care of your own body, no separation.
Can you talk about what's going on physically there?
So I have a story that I want to tell you, and then I want to talk about it. There is a tribe in Africa, in Northern Africa, that from the time that they're hunter-gatherers and from the time that they're children, they're taught to listen for and communicate with the honey guide bird. And that bird comes looking for them. And when the bird finds them, it sings them its song, and then they have a song that they sing back to the honey guide bird. And there's been research done on this, and the way that they sing to the honey guide bird produces this next thing that happens, which is the bird then flies around, and they follow it, and it takes them to honey inside of a tree. So the bird finds the honey, goes and finds the humans, tells the humans, hey, got some honey for you, and then leads them to it. Then the humans smoke out the bees, the African bees, take down the honey comb and allow the bird to eat the larvae out of it and give them the first chunk of the honey. So it's this reciprocal relationship between humans and birds. And this is just one small example of how we as human animals are not separate from nature. That is a big lie that we were somehow fed around the same time that we were fed the lie that somehow we were separate from our bodies, because neither are true. They're completely untrue, but our misunderstanding of this leads to a lot of poor treatment of ourselves, our bodies, and of nature, and really denigrating the body, including many of our religious traditions, which we could talk about in more detail. The truth is that when we are, whatever you think, whatever you do with your mind has a profound impact on your body, all your neurotransmitters and your hormones, et cetera, that we are 100% connected. You can't do one thing with your mind and have it not impact your body. They are all exactly one. And when you're with other people, like I love this, if you cuddle on a couch with your dog, for example, and you're petting your dog, your heart rhythm will sync up with the dog's heart rhythm. The same thing happens with a friend or with a parent or with a kid. You know, it happens with someone that you care about. Your heart energy rhythms actually become equivalent, you know, and if it's a dog, maybe at a different rate, but the rhythm is the same. So we do this, our electromagnetic field of the heart goes out about 3 feet in either direction from your body. So every time you're near a human, whether it's on the subway or you're in a crowd or you're at work and your desk is near somebody, you're actually impacting each other. And not just that heart field, so that getting into the same rhythm, but then the mirror neurons in your brain are actually reflecting what they're feeling. They're sensing and reflecting what they're feeling. And this is why there's all that research showing that the more friends that you have are depressed, the more likely you are to be depressed. And the more friends that you have that are overweight, the more likely you are to be overweight, because we're literally sharing electrical connections with people that are then reflected in our own physiology, in our neurochemistry, and in our endocrine hormonal system. So we are absolutely connected to other, not just other humans, but other animals as well. And then there's all this fascinating research on the relationship between humans and plants, where how you feel actually affects how the tree reacts or how the plant reacts. And we now have all this beautiful research. A lot of it was pioneered by Suzanne Simard, who's a friend of mine. She is a Canadian researcher, and she researched the mother tree in the forests. So in intact forests that have not been logged, so virgin forests that have existed for a while, there is this massive underground root system that both the tree roots and the fungal roots that are all connected. It's this symbiotic system where they help each other get the nutrients that they need, but they also communicate with them. So there will be a central tree, a big tree, that will actually send nutrients to her babies away from her. And in an intact forest where there's a mother tree, the baby trees are four times as likely to survive as if they're not, but then one that's not, let's say it's a small tree in a forest where it's been logged and there's not the same connections underground. And when you walk in those forests under one footprint is 10 kilometers of these networks under your feet. It's this incredibly dense system of connection of which we're pretty much unaware, but of course also is part of the connectedness of our world when we walk on the earth. So the nature is massively interconnected. We are connected to animals and trees and plants in these ways that are not imaginary. They're actually measurable, and they have been shown in research to be the case. And that's because we needed those kinds of connected skills with ourselves, with our own intuition, with other animals in order to survive as human animals. This crazy world we live in right now is very different from the world we were adapted for. Our physiology is 10,000 years old. And we are now, you know, for the last, 400 years, living with the degree of inside, sitting down, no hands in the soil, never touching the ground, not in nature, in front of a screen that we're doing, and eating, you know, crappy food, processed food. All of that's new, very new. And it doesn't look so good for the human animal because it's not what the human animal is made for.
Are we seeing changes? Are you seeing changes in your practice physiologically in people that are starting to show up as almost like evolutionary changes in reaction to this 400 years of doing what we're not built to do?
100%. So in my book, Bodywise, I talk about, I describe it as chronic body depletion. And it's this combination of distraction, because human animals were made to know between 150 and 1,000 people, and that's it. So, you know, the big news and the tragedies and the births and the celebrations were in this small group of people, and then we're inundated through television and media with far more than our nervous system is really built for, especially if we allow ourselves to get pulled into it. And then, you know, we were made to be active every day, and most people are quite sedentary. So in my office, I see all the time people are anxious. You and I were just discussing earlier that the level of anxiety among people in the United States is steadily increasing. And by the way, we are the most anxious country in the world. And it's partly because we don't protect our working people. We don't limit hours. We don't require vacations. We don't give maternity leave. You know, we don't have, like they do in other developed busy countries like Europe, you know, they get 6 weeks of vacation. It's different, feels different. Yeah,
and here we reward people for being online all day long and all night.
We do. Yeah. We reward people for productivity. But what happens is we have breakdown of the body. So people come into me anxious, depressed, exhausted, overweight, insomnia, lack of sex drive, and then with all this disturbance in the gut which is interestingly metaphoric. So I don't know how much you know about the gut microbiome, but there is literally a forest of bacteria in our intestines. There are 10 times as many bacterial cells in our large intestine as there are human cells in the body. So you are a walking rainforest for a bunch of bacteria that are absolutely essential to your health. This is evolutionary medicine. Like, what were we built for? And what is the environment we're currently living in? And how can we help you as a human who has certain choices? Now, people are limited by income. People are limited by their caretaking responsibilities. I'm not pretending everyone has full freedom to make choices, because that's not true. But most of us have some choices. And if we can be smarter about choosing the food and drink that's closer to what our body wants, about choosing more activity when we can that's closer to what our body needs, about sleeping more. Honestly, if I could just get people to sleep more, it would make a giant difference. And then love and relationship. These are the five fundamentals of health I talk about. So love and relationship is the fourth. And then a sense of purpose. Like, why are you really here? And those five things, if we really get in touch with them from this perspective of what does my body need? What is the language of my body telling me about what it needs? Then we can still live in this beautiful modern world with technology. I'm not anti-technology, but we can consume it and use it for our benefit and not be controlled by it.
I read in one of your interviews that you always ask your patients about their relationships.
Always.
Yeah. How does that go?
Well, I don't know how people practice without asking people about their relationships, to be honest. I couldn't practice medicine without hearing about that, because often the entire key to, I mean, if you really want to get to the root of a problem, a medical problem, you have to ask about relationships. I mean, it is rare that it's so straightforward that I don't need to know whether they're married, whether they're in an abusive relationship, where they live, what kind of work they do, what family they grew up in. Those things are all essential to the development of disease, especially in the modern day, because 90% of illness that presents to doctors' offices is caused by lifestyle.
So I want to go a little bit deeper into that. So we were talking earlier about the importance of having a strong social support network, and of course, the importance of, for those who are in committed relationships with a partner, that being healthy. What sort of things are you hearing from people when you ask them about this?
About relationship?
Yeah.
Well, a whole variety of things, as you might imagine. Like, here's a good story. I have a woman in my practice who I love, who came to see me for the first time because she was having abdominal pain and she was going to her regular doctor. And her regular doctor was a good doctor who said, oh, sounds like it could be gallbladder disease. She did an ultrasound. She had gallstones in her gallbladder, which is not uncommon, by the way, and said, oh, you need your gallbladder out. That's the problem. But this woman didn't want to have surgery. And she came to see me because I'm a, you know, integrative weirdo doctor who helps people, you know, do things without medicine and without intervention when I can. Not that I don't love surgery when I need it, when my patients need it, because I do.
Only the best weirdo doctor in Santa Cruz, like 8 or 9 years in a row.
So she came to see me because she didn't want to have surgery. And so I started talking. So this is the thing, right? I started asking her about, well, it's really interesting. When does the pain happen? And then we go into a little deep. Well, what are you doing? What are you doing right before it happens? And she said, oh, I'm talking to my mom on the phone. It's like, you're always talking to your mom on the phone before the pain happens? Yeah, I think so, she says. And I look at her labs. She's not in any imminent danger. She doesn't have inflammation in the gallbladder. She doesn't need an emergency gallbladder removal. Sometimes people do, but she doesn't. Mm-hmm. So I say, okay, here's our plan. And then I'm like, well, tell me about your mom, right? And her mom was emotionally abusive and neglectful her entire childhood. And now her mom is elderly and she's an only child, and she feels responsible for checking in with her because she's her only human family member that's alive. But at the same time, her mother is still abusive to her over the phone. And then she gets abdominal pain. I mean, I love the body is such a beautiful metaphor, you know, just how we dream in metaphors, the body expresses in metaphors. Like, she can't digest what her mother's giving her, right? So she's having pain. Now, it could even be gallbladder pain. But my suggestion is, hey, let's not touch your mom for a month, right? So that's what we did. And she saw me a month later and she hadn't had any pain.
Wow.
So she wasn't happy with this. She's actually someone who had done a tremendous amount of personal work, and she still felt like it was would be better if she were in touch with her mother. So we talked about boundaries. She did a little more counseling. She made agreements with herself. I find, you know, a huge piece of adult maturation is, can you trust yourself to take care of yourself? Which sounds simple, and it's not. You know, does your body trust you to take care of it? Does your body know that if you are in pain that you'll stop doing the exercise you're doing? Does it know that, you know, when something hurts you that you'll stop, right? She had to establish this agreement with her body that if the conversation with her mother gets abusive, that she'll get off the phone immediately.
Is that one of the examples of teaching someone to establish boundaries? Because I feel like it's one thing to say, you know, you just need stronger boundaries, let's help you do that, versus how does one actually begin to, you know, practice that, right? What does it look like to practice establishing better boundaries?
Right. So she's a great example, because for her, she had to listen to her body. When does her chest begin to squeeze? When does her belly begin to hurt? Oh, okay. That means whatever they're talking about is not working for her. Whether it's the vocabulary or it's the tone or whatever it is, it's not working for her. And she has to get off the phone. So she has to be body wise. She has to develop her body wisdom, because the body tells you what's up. If you pay attention, this is what my book Body Wise is about, which is teaching people to listen closely to the signals their body is giving them, whether it's pain or it's tingling or it's tightness or it's shortness of breath or, you know, whatever it is in a situation. And most folks are familiar with the term gut intuition. And that's what I'm talking about here, this deep sense within your body about what's happening and what kinds, you know, how to lead you in a direction that's going to be better for you.
One of the things that you mentioned when you were talking about the physiological impact of other people around you and nature, it reminded me of the movie I Am, and the scene where he's sitting with somebody from HeartMath, and they're actually measuring this petri dish in front of him. That petri dish's changes when he's starting to have stressful thoughts.
Yes.
And that was the first time that I'd ever seen that be measured, let alone put it in a video. That was the first time I ever actually knew that that was possible. And that sounds like what you're talking about. And it's just a way to just prove that this is indeed what happens. And I wonder, like, knowing that, what do people do with that information, right? Like, okay, great. So we know that we all are connected on a deeper energetic level than we ever knew. And now we can prove it. You know, how do we use that information for our greatest benefit?
Well, it's a really good question. And I want to tell you about another study, because I just think it's a really interesting lens through which to look at this. So there's this great study where they had couples, these happened to be heterosexual couples, and they had the female member of the couple watch a disturbing short video, very disturbing content. And they measured her, you know, before she watched it, and after she watched it, her cortisol levels, her adrenaline levels, and her neurotransmitters. And they measured the same in her partner. And then she went to be with her, there were several different groups. So in one group, she went to be with her partner. She told him about the video and how she felt about it. Her cortisol dropped very quickly back to normal, and his never went up. In another group, they told her, you can't tell your partner what you just saw. You can't share it with him. So she goes out. She's had this disturbing experience. She doesn't tell her partner about it. Her cortisol is high, stays high. Her adrenaline stays high. His cortisol is high. His adrenaline is high. He didn't watch it. He didn't experience it, but he's standing next to someone who he loves who's disturbed, and his body is disturbed, right?
Wow.
This is how the human body works. This is how the human body works. So, you know, one thing I would say to that is that I think it is most useful to be truthful. Most of the time. And I would say I learned this primarily through my romantic relationship, but it would absolutely apply in my business relationships, that even when it's uncomfortable, if you're having these feelings and you're thinking inside your head, you're somehow going to behave differently. It doesn't really work. It doesn't really work anyway. You might as well be honest, even though it's uncomfortable, and take responsibility. So, you know, it's another huge relationship skill, which is, I'm feeling this, not you're making me feel blamed, but mm-hmm. I feel lesser than, I feel uncomfortable, I feel, you know, claiming your own responsibility for your feelings. But it's, life is a lot easier if you, number one, can feel them. So there's the learning how to listen inside yourself. And number two, you can be honest about them in those situations, because you'll have much cleaner, clearer relationships with people.
I wonder how much technology is actually creating this downward spiral between people, where, you know, I come to LA often, and I go to Cafe Gratitude. Have you been there?
Yeah.
Like in Venice. And it's like, you know, supposed to be this super conscious, really, you know, amazing, intentional place. And it is, for the most part. But last time I was there, I was eating alone. I was there for business. And I looked around, and there were all these two people at a table, maybe like most of them, I witnessed both people on their cell phones the majority of their dinner. And they did not look like they were having a good time. They were just kind of doing this thing, and every once in a while, like, you know, lazily looking up at the other person and saying something. And they looked like they really didn't want to be there. And it made me wonder, like, as you're talking, I'm thinking, well, okay, if we're feeding off of the energy of the other person, and then this other person is feeding off of ours, and we're just going into numbing mode and getting into our phones, like, are we causing a downward spiral with one another?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we're in a cultural crisis of massive proportions. It's not going to get better. It's going to get worse. Because we've got children now who learn how to interact with a screen before they learn how to interact with humans. Our ability to look at each other in the eye and actually read micro expressions is amazing. First of all, it's remarkable what we know from looking, just briefly looking at somebody's face, what they're feeling or what they're expressing. But our inability to do that means that our ability to communicate with others is dramatically reduced, or tell when they're distressed, or tell when they're upset. That is to have relationship, right? you really need all those skills. And it's also those face-to-face interactions are what decrease our cortisol levels. We already talked about how the millennials are the most anxious generation to ever exist. Well, anxiety is high cortisol, high adrenaline levels. It's a feeling of unsafety. And the way that we feel safe is through physical touch from other living beings. It can be a dog, but, you know, humans, preferably at least some of the time, a safe human. And through being with people who have a calming influence. It's like the mother with the mother with the child. We have to have other humans to do that with. We are not leopards. We don't live lone lives. We are pack animals like dogs. We actually need each other for normal physiologic functioning. And when we don't have each other, when we don't touch each other, when we don't interact with each other and look each other in the eye, our cortisol levels are higher. And high cortisol causes heart attacks, strokes, breakdown of muscle tissue, injury. You know, it has all these and suppressed immune systems. You're more likely to get sick, and you're more likely to get cancer. So it's a huge impact.
So, I mean, what choices do we have? You know, you talked about kids growing up looking at screens and learning to interact with the screen before other humans. And then I know you guys have young adult children, and I'm not sure at what point technology got to this point of ubiquity when they were growing up. But for the children out there, for the ones who are just entering into the world as adults, like, how can we help that generation?
Well, I feel really strongly that children, and I did this, TV was very ubiquitous, you know, not so much, we didn't have pads for children like they do now, but television certainly was a big thing, and computers and computer games were all happening when my kids were little. And we were strict about, they had videos that they could play that we selected, and there was no television. And they got computers around age 10, I want to say. And they could play computer games. They didn't have an Xbox, but they could play occasionally computer games on the computer. They all kind of sucked, which was our intention. They weren't that good, so they played them not much. Right. But I was hell-bent on my kids being able to look people in the eye and have interesting conversations and sit at the table and interact with people of all ages. which they all do. But as a parent, you know, as a parent, your job is to limit what your kid is exposed to. And if you're telling yourself, oh, it's so much easier, I just give him the pad and now he can fly on the airplane. Yeah, easier in the short term, not in the long term. And so much of parenting is like this. You make the hard decisions up front, but then in the long term, you have functional, adapted children who can love and be in relationship. And isn't that what we all want? And I don't want to suggest that you have to be a purist and have nothing in your house. Like my kids did watch movies, right? And they did get a crappy computer eventually. And they did have phones in high school. You know, I'm not, I don't think that total isolation is such a good idea. First of all, it's not going to happen. That's a fantasy. And, but I do think it's important to watch your child, you know, who is this human that's come to live with you and what are their needs and what are their strengths and what are their weaknesses? Some kids have a much harder time with social interaction than other kids and they need more help staying away from media and actually being with humans.
You know, it makes me wonder, is there going to be this like subset of this younger generation who is almost like acting out against all of technology and acting out in a way that they want to revert back to the way things used to be? And I guess we're only going to see how things play out and see if that happens. But I have my boyfriend's niece, one of his nieces is 5, and she calls the parents out for the phones as well. And it makes me wonder if like you're doing that before you can even likely remember doing that when you're older. Is it going to be so ingrained that your behavior is such that I use this thing as a tool and that's it?
Right. But that's how it should be used.
Yeah. Have you seen the research about how when we have our phones in our sight, that we actually become less intelligent? And that if we have it on our person, we can actually still feel it and we know it's there, that it's still, it's like some varying degrees of how much intellect we have access to. So if we can see it, then it's the most blocked amount of intellect. And then if we can feel it and we know that it's right around the corner, like in our, you know, peripheral, it still impacts us. And then it's only when it's literally like hidden and we can't like feel it, see it, sense it, that we have full capacity.
That makes sense to me. Because yeah, it's our accessory brain. It's that thing that we keep next to us that backs us up all the time so that we no longer have to remember phone numbers, for example. I had to remember phone numbers when I was a kid.
Right? So imagine, right, like when you think about two people sitting at the dinner table at, well, anywhere, but I'll go back to Cafe Gratitude, even if it's face down, because I guess people think it's polite to put the phone face down instead of face up, right? Like that's a big move. Well, even that is still going to be, you know, hijacking our brain to a big degree. And, you know, I started actually just being vocal about it when I'm out with my friends, because we're not going to have that quality time that we could have if there's that little hijacking from our freaking device every time.
Right. And not to be a revolutionary, but I really do think that those dinnertime conversations among friends, when everyone is engaged, is where we get new ideas to help tilt our planet in the right direction. You know, we've got some work to do here. There's the planet and the people and the animals and nature need us, right? We all need to be on our game. And I'm not saying don't play. In fact, yes, play. More creativity comes with play. You know, conversation should be playful. But if you're distracted by technology, you're not going to have, you know, I don't know when you came up with the idea for what you're doing now, for example, but it usually comes in conversation with other people, right? You get an idea sparked and then somebody runs with it. And this is how we, you know, live up to our creative potential.
Do you have any sort of, I feel like this might be too heavy-handed and structured sounding, so feel free to tell me no, but do you have any sort of thing that you do or certain questions that you ask or like formats that you follow for these types of conversations with friends that are a little bit more structured than just the organic, like, how are we going to solve the world?
Usually we just start talking about what we care about. It's not more structured than that. But if you really get to the heart of what somebody's passionate about, even if they're passionate about, like, I'm really passionate about beach volleyball, for example. I love it so much. It makes me so happy. But if you get me talking about that, I'm going to start talking about how wow, it's so great as a woman to be able to be competitive or to be able to be, to have a safe place to be aggressive with people who love it, support it, and celebrate it, right? Mm-hmm. And the fact that my girlfriends are, you know, with me and everybody's in agreement and that we trade partners. So you never, it's never one against all. It's always everybody sharing and just this beautiful communal context. And by the way, my naked feet are in the sand. So I'm getting electrically grounded into the earth and the waves are, you know, there's a lot of, if you talk to me about what seems like a simple subject, you're going to get to my deep values, right? For community, for full self-expression, for acceptance, you know, sharing all these things that are really important to me.
Oh, the only thing that stands between me and you getting to that part of the conversation is me asking the follow-up question of what is it about, in this case, beach volleyball, but what is it about this thing you love? Why do you like this person? Why do you like doing this thing? Why do you volunteer in this way? Instead of just going like, cool, I just heard a fact about you. Moving on. Yes. And that's something that everybody can do in conversation. I think we would learn so much more about our friends that we already know so well if we did that. That's what's one of the reasons that we're talking so much about at Fabric, how can we help people deepen their relationships? Because we hear a lot about that people feel like their relationships are not as fulfilling as they want, and they want to be able to go deeper, and they don't know how.
Yes. So, and then the 8 Dates book, which we just wrote with John and Julie Gottman, Doug and I wrote with John and Julie Gottman, is a beautiful example of really helping people to do just that. And I think we are all absolutely thrilled and a little surprised at how it's a bestseller. It's been doing great. And I think it literally is because that book is, it looks manageable. So it's not a big, thick, a ton of text relationship book. It's thin. And then it sends you on dates. So there's something to do. And then there's quizzes, you know, there are these things in engagement and questions that you ask somebody so that lead you into those conversations around money, around trust, around play, around sex, you know, around the things that are hard to talk about. It's structured conversations that allow you to have that deep connection with someone. And I mean, we wrote these dates, but you know, Doug and I went on all of them and I learned stuff I'd never heard from him before. It was fascinating. Super fun.
Wow. After 30 years or so together?
30 years together.
Wow. So, okay. What's your favorite date
in that book? Oh my goodness. Well, I did talk about this where you and I met at Wisdom 2.0, but I really like the conflict date. And the reason is that everybody has conflict or you're in denial, but being in denial and avoiding conflict is actually just as bad as having conflict. And you have conflict because you're two different people, whether you're two women or two men or a man and a woman or you're ungendered, it doesn't matter. You're two different humans and you're going to go about life differently, but you're trying to live life together, at least some of it. And there's a lot of important conversations to have about the practical aspects and about the fun and interesting aspects. And in the conflict date, you really get a sense of how this other person likes to have a conflict, because shocker, we're not all the same. Some people are hyperverbal and their volume goes up, and some people withdraw into a shell and are really quiet, but when they speak, it's very profound. You know, people have really different ways of being in conflict, and it's helpful to know what your partner's conflict style is. And then to have ground rules for conflict, like what we talked about earlier. I take responsibility for my emotions. I don't say, "You're such a bitch. You know, you told me to do this and I felt left out." And, you know, you say, "Oh, I felt sad and left out. I felt, you know, when this happened, I felt this way." You take responsibility. And then you allow both people to have an opportunity to speak without being interrupted. And you listen attentively. This sounds simple and it's totally transformational, because when you listen in that way and you're really paying attention, you'll understand your partner at a whole nother level and even develop some compassion. You may not agree with them and you don't have to. Many people don't agree. You can still have a great relationship. But you do get this deeper understanding of, oh, that's who you are. Oh, and by the way, what from your past reminds you of this? Oh, it's because of your relationship with your dad. Now I understand. You react this way because your dad, you know, was always afraid of being disrespected and was very hard on you. And so when I do this thing, you get really offended and you feel disrespected and it lands heavily emotionally for you in a way that I don't understand because I didn't have that experience. but I don't agree with it, but I can have compassion for it. So that's really what we're looking for.
What are the eight? So there's, you said trust, play, conflict, sex. What are the next four?
On the spot here. Here I go. Dreams, work, family, including children or not children, extended family, and sex. Did we say sex?
Maybe. We said sex. It's worth saying twice.
Oh, it's an important one. Money.
Mm. Is the eight dates the formats that you have? Are they something that people can use for relationships outside of romantic relationships?
It's a great question. A lot of it is. Like, you can have a conversation with money about money with your siblings. That's really interesting. I just my sister recently. Or about play with your friends. So it's structured so that much of it you can talk about with someone that you're not in romantic relationship with. And I think it would be really helpful. I'm a huge, I mean, and I think you and I spoke about this earlier, but I'm really using the term right relationship as a way to put a context around how do you have this right relationship with yourself? How do you have a right relationship with other people, whether it's your romantic partner or your, you know, people at work or people in your family? And how do you have right relationship with the earth, with the natural world? Mm-hmm. And I think that the Eight Dates book is really an attempt to create a structure in which to develop right relationship. And we may be working on another project that is more general outside of romantic relationship.
I can't wait to see what happens there. What I love about this in particular with the Eight Dates book is that, you know, going back to social wellness and the fact that we're not learning this stuff when we're growing up, unless we're some of the kids that are lucky enough to get some of this, you know, very forward training in schools. That's not happening for most people. And so we are not learning this. And so I think that the fact that you're creating fun, facilitated conversations for people to do is just, you know, we go to trainers for working out, we go to therapists for our mental health. And why don't we turn to some support for our relationships and our conversations and how we can go deeper and be in right relationship with the folks around us? So I just commend you for putting that work out there in a way that, you know, for people, even for people who have been married for 30 plus years or folks who are just starting to date, like, what is the harm in saying, hey, like, here's a tool that, and we use tools in so many other areas of our lives, here's a tool that we can use to try to understand each other better and to get closer. I just love that. Thank you for that.
You're welcome. And I also wouldn't say, and certainly the Gottmans wouldn't say, that every couple or every family needs to relate in the same way. Not everybody's going to have extended, deep, long conversations because not everybody enjoys that. And that's not necessary. You need to have enough of a conversation. That's what these eight dates are about. You have to have enough of a conversation about those important subjects. Like when we're talking about community, you know, I grew up in the Midwest. There were people who would hang out at the bowling alley, or they would hang out after work at the diner and just chit chat. And that's community. You know, that is still really good for the human animal. It doesn't have to be, or the guys who hang out and they like do something together. You know, they play, or they watch football, they play a game. I mean, those kinds of things are still really beneficial. It doesn't all have to be deep conversation. It's just being in relationship to others that's beneficial to us.
You mentioned the, you didn't call it this, but you mentioned Dunbar's number, 150 relationships, and how the research has shown us that, you know, it's not an exact number, but that we can only effectively maintain a certain number, and it's certainly in the low hundreds of real relationships in our lives. And it's actually one of the reasons that with Fabric, you can only put 50 people in there, your first three circles. And it's not about amassing more than that because we have enough of that. And I think that that's also, you know, when you give the image of people just hanging out on, you know, at the diner, or I think about the porch swing, right? And on the block where neighbors are walking by and sharing tea together in the summer. I mean, I actually have memories of that when I was a child. And then of course we don't see it at all anymore. And those are the folks that are always going to be there in your life in a close way, even if they're not your immediate family. And you can't get that with the 500 people you know on Facebook.
No.
Yeah.
My parents were elderly, and my dad was a pastor, and they live in a relatively small town in southern Illinois. And I'm telling you, they've got people coming by all the time. I don't live there, but to take them for a walk, to take them out to lunch, to bring them dinner, to drive them to church, to take them to choir practice. You know, they have community. They have a committed community of people that they've known for decades, that they've served for decades, that are now holding them as they get older. And we're missing that, you know, that used to, we're not missing it everywhere, mind you, because there are still parts of this country. And in fact, people know less of their neighbors now and trust their neighbors less than 30 years ago, quite a bit less, but it's less true in rural areas. So there are still many parts of this country that are still more community oriented, and they tend to not be in cities. However, we're going to have more and more people in cities as our world develops over the next several decades. And so I want to figure out, you know, how do we help those in cities who tend to be more isolated from their neighbors and know more less about where they live and the people where they live, to have more of those connections we're talking about.
This is amazing. I could talk to you forever, but we do need to wrap up. So I have a few questions, and then we'll sign off. So awesome. The first is, we love playing what we call connectivities here, connection activities. And if you're game, I'll ask you a question and then you can answer, and then you can flip it on me if you'd like.
Great.
So the question I'd like to ask is, there's a phrase that I've heard a lot that is, we teach that which we need to learn the most. Uh-huh. What is that for you?
I think it's marriage and relationship, honestly. Taking care of my own body, right? So this is my professional work in the world. But you know, my parents had a rough marriage, and I did not want that. And I was hell bent on either not getting married at all or doing it right. And the doing it right is my life, part of my life work. You know, how do I be in respectful, kind, self-responsible conversation and relationship with this man that I've chosen to spend my life with? So that would be one thing. And then parenting too was hugely important to me, to be present, to be emotionally present for my kids. And then to take care of myself in the process. And that is really the conundrum of the modern female that is so much easier now because my kids are no longer home. But I would say that that's both my work in the world and the thing I'm passionate about and the thing I needed to learn in order to survive and be happy and thrive.
Thank you.
All right, Amy.
Do you want me to go?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I ask myself why I've spent the past 7 years, you know, first working in a events company that brought together like-minded singles around yoga. It's called Yoga Dates. And then doing a mindful dating app and now doing a social wellness app. And I think what it all comes back to is the desire to dig in and learn all that I can about true, meaningful, authentic, intentional connections between humans and what A, that means, and B, what it takes to get that. Because I feel like, you know, we've talked a lot about this, that the world is set up right now to be against us in many ways in that area. And so I feel like we have so much work to do to just counteract these forces, and that we can do it. And I just am so obsessed with finding the answers to how we can get that, because the research shows, and we all know, that connection is what we need more than anything. And I didn't get a lot of, I had to learn that as an adult. I had to learn what it took to do that. And so I think I'm hell-bent on teaching it and learning at the same time.
Yeah. Great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Me too.
Yeah.
Me too. Because I think that the more connected we are to each other, the better care we take of each other and the better world we live in.
Yeah. Thanks. All right. We're going to wrap with two quick things. First, I would love, because this feels like a new conversation in the consumer space, in the mainstream world, if you will, of what social wellness even is. I would love for you to define it in your words. And then, if you're game, give our listeners one challenge that you would give them based on your work and what's really important to you for them to try on to help improve their own social well-being.
Mm-hmm. I would say that not everyone's going to have a lot of close friends. Some people are more introverted. They only want a few, but that everyone needs at least three people that if you went into the hospital, you would tell, or that if you were really sick, you would tell, or if you lost your job, that you would tell. Three people that you're in at least weekly contact with, that you have that level of closeness with. I think that it, and lots of people talk about that. Nobody talks about this, but I think people need to be touched. So if you are living by yourself or you're living with another person, but you're just not physically affectionate with them, you got to find ways to be, that social wellness also is about human touch, whether it's a hug or a handshake or a slap on the back or a massage or actual romantic involvement. You know, it doesn't matter, but the human touch does matter and that it's good for the organism and it helps with bodily healing. And that there should, each of us should have at least five different social groups of people that we're in contact with, by which I mean, you know, a spouse is one, family members are another one, work colleagues are another one, religious community is another one, any other community like sport, a sport community you're a part of, or a bowling league or something is another one, a volunteer community is another one. Everyone should have at least three or four communities that they're identified with so that your social reach is such that when you break your leg or you have, you know, an operation, that there are people who care about you and they're going to, or you have a baby and they bring you a meal train. You know, I think we need that kind of community involvement.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you. And I know we didn't get to Naked Shabbat, but for anybody who's interested about Rachel and Doug's Naked Shabbat commitment, maybe you can dig around on the internet and find a talk about that, or try it on for yourself, and whatever that means to you, give it a shot.
It's really simple. It's just no other people, no other activities, no electronics, a period of time, at least a day, where you're preferably horizontal and you're preferably naked. Those are the only rules.
Who doesn't want that?
Who doesn't want that? Who's never done it and doesn't know how great it is?
It's been amazing talking to you. I'm just so impressed with the work that you're doing and the energy that you bring to it. And I'm excited to see what's next for you. And just stoked to know you.
Thank you, Amy. I feel the same. Thank you so much for the work you're doing. You and my kids' generations really give me hope. And not that I expect to be saved by other people. I want to do my own work. But I just feel like we have a lot of really good-hearted, smart-thinking young people. God bless. You know, it's wonderful.
Yeah. Have a great weekend. Enjoy Naked Shabbat.
You too.
Bye-bye. Bye. Don't forget to subscribe to Wellness 3.0, available on iTunes, Google Play Music, Spotify, and Stitcher. And if you're loving our show, please rate us and leave us a review. It's how we can continue to spread the word about the importance of social wellness today. Thank you.